Connecticut, not unlike New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, has a very low rate of firearm-related deaths. You know, the most common firearm-related death is not a homicide, it's a suicide. And obviously, many suicides are impulse-driven. And access to a firearm makes carrying out that impulse much easier.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, I speak with Mike Lawler. He's a former member of the Connecticut House of Representatives who wrote that state's landmark red flag law in 1999. Now he teaches criminal justice at the University of New Haven. We spoke Wednesday about the mass shooting in Boulder, constitutional concerns around gun control, and why he thinks a federal approach to red flag laws is needed. We're speaking about, unfortunately, awful news, this mass shooting in Boulder, which follows another one in recent days in the Atlanta area. As you see these shootings pick back up, what's your initial reaction?
Well, I mean, each one of these episodes points a spotlight at shortcomings in our system for regulating gun possession, gun sales throughout the country. You know, as it turns out, some states, including my state, Connecticut, have made great strides in closing these loopholes, but other states, including Georgia and Colorado, have not.
It's too early to really know that many details about what has transpired in Boulder, but based on what I've read, it seems as if the alleged shooter in this case would have been a candidate for the red flag law like Connecticut's, which you wrote back in 1999. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all reading the same thing, and there's no question this young guy would have certainly been a subject of our red flag law. But it relies on people saying something, right? I mean, we have this constant mantra of saying, you know, if you see something, say something. And based on press reports, it sounds like his immediate family were well aware that he had some serious mental health issues. Whether or not he ever got treatment for those, we don't know. But what we do know is just a couple of days before this shooting, they saw him walking around the house with what they described as a machine gun. And one would think that if you put two and two together, a history of paranoia and other serious mental health syndromes, plus sudden acquisition of an assault weapon, you would think to reach out to somebody and raise the alarm, wave the red flag. But that obviously did not happen.
Why are people afraid to do that?
I'm not sure if people are afraid to do it. I think people aren't sure that they have the option of doing it. In Colorado, clearly they do not. But you can always call the police and you can always explain what you're seeing. The question is, what, if any, action can the police take in a situation like that? And on top of that, right, you know, without in any way stigmatizing persons with mental illness, and I think that's an important goal to not do that, but when you see someone who has a lifetime of very serious mental health symptoms, you know, you've got to do something. Try and get them into treatment. You know, it sounds like his family was relatively sophisticated. Why they, assuming they did not ever seek out such treatment, you have to ask the question why, because that by itself could have prevented this tragedy.
So back to the issue of a red flag law, how does the law that you worked on in Connecticut about two decades ago actually work?
So the Connecticut law was inspired by a couple of tragedies here where there was, in one case, an employee came in and shot up the Connecticut Lottery headquarters and killed a bunch of his coworkers. And in that particular case, people said after the fact, well, we're not surprised. He showed all these signs. He was acquiring guns. He attempted suicide. He had a grudge, you know. And it occurred to some of us that, you know, why can't there be an option to do something prior to the tragedy actually taking place, right? Because, you know, it is legal to have a gun in Connecticut and most other places, right? At what point do you try and do something when people have guns and they're displaying the kinds of behavior that leads you to believe they're an imminent risk to themselves or to others? And that's why we wrote this law. And what it basically says is if you reach out to the police and report that someone has guns and appears to pose an imminent risk to themselves or to others, the police are required to do an investigation and present it in the form of a warrant application to a judge. And if a judge makes a finding that there's probable cause to believe that the person actually has access to guns and is an imminent risk to themselves or others, the police have a warrant. They can seize the guns, if appropriate, refer the person or bring the person to a mental health evaluation. And then the process by which that person gets their guns back is all takes place in court, where the state has a burden of proof. So in other words, it fulfills the very important Fourth Amendment safeguards about searching and seizing items from people, right? But on the other hand, it's pretty clear in retrospect that it has prevented so many tragedies, both suicides and homicides. This has been studied extensively by academic experts. They've determined that our law has been effective, and I think that's why so many states now are copying it.
You kind of led me to this next question. It's hard to prove a negative. How do you know that it has worked?
Well, I mean, for starters, Connecticut, not unlike New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, has a very low rate of firearm-related deaths. You know, the most common firearm-related death is not a homicide, it's a suicide. And obviously, many suicides are impulse-driven. And access to a firearm makes carrying out that impulse much easier. And I think what we found in Connecticut is that the most frequent person to report somebody to the police are actually mental health providers themselves. I mean, they have a duty to warn. It's an exception to medical, you know, doctor-patient confidentiality. And in many cases, they're the ones who reach out. And also family members are the ones who reach out and say, hey, we're concerned about this person. And so what we've been able to do is demonstrate, you know, before and after the law took effect, the number of suicides related to firearms, and it's clearly dropped. And there was an extensive study done by the Duke University Medical School, some researchers at Yale University, which concluded that the rate of suicides was clearly affected by the existence of the red flag law. Plus, we know how many times it's been used. And, you know, if you're like me and you've read many of these warrants that the police brought to judges to sign, you can see the very clear signs of imminent danger. You know, many of these people not only had one gun, but literally had hundreds of weapons in their homes and thousands upon thousands of rounds of ammunition, you know, plus things like pictures of Hitler and all, you know, samurai swords and hand grenades. And many of these people were completely off the mental health radar screen up until this point. And many of these people were able to get treatment and, you know, return to somewhat normal life. But it's such an important tool to have without in any way violating people's Fourth Amendment rights related to search and seizure and due process, and their Second Amendment rights related to possession of firearms.
Well, let's touch on that for a second. Say more about that. The Supreme Court has affirmed an individual right to keep and bear arms, and it hasn't set a limit on how many guns you can have. So what do you say to those who would argue that a red flag law is an infringement of the Second Amendment?
Well, it's not any more than the law that says if you're a convicted felon, you are not allowed to possess firearms. It's based on due process. It's based on evidence. It's based on decisions made by judges and hearings that take place in court where you have all the rights to due process. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people are prohibited from possessing firearms in every state, including the reddest of red states. And just for example, if you are convicted of a felony, you are not allowed to possess firearms. And I'm not sure there's people who disagree with that law. So if that law is constitutional, why isn't another law that it's based on your behavior that disqualifies you from possessing firearms? You know, I would argue that Connecticut has a well-regulated system of governing acquisition and possession of firearms. And that's what the Constitution describes.
Lastly, President Biden did speak shortly after news of the Boulder shooting on Tuesday, and he reiterated support for some federal gun control measures. You mentioned earlier that it's really a patchwork right now in terms of different laws for different states. Some states have, you know, red flag laws, some states don't, and some states have enacted restrictions on automatic weapons, other states haven't. Do you think this is something that really needs to be done at the federal level?
Well, ideally, it would happen at the federal level because, you know, all we know for sure is the states that have these reasonable but yet extensive rules governing firearms have a very low incidence of firearm-related deaths. We know that. And Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts lead the pack. And we know the states that have virtually no limitations on acquisition and possession of firearms have by far the highest rates. And the gap is pretty wide, too. And so we have these prototypes. We know they work. We know that law-abiding citizens in Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts have a right to keep and bear arms. They absolutely do. It's in our state constitution as well. But we have an obligation to regulate that. And as long as we do so with respecting people's rights and have a defensible system for doing this, and as long as we don't prohibit people from possessing firearms altogether, I think we're well within the guardrails of the Second Amendment.
Mike Lawler teaches criminal justice at the University of New Haven in Connecticut, and he's a former member of the Connecticut House of Representatives. Thank you for taking this time for us. Appreciate your insights.
Thanks, Ian.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.